Welcome back. It's the Coaches Rising podcast. Today, I'm joined again by Nicholas Yanni. I always enjoy my conversations with Nicholas, and today was no exception. So we're going to talk about the call for coaches in this time. What is the kind of coaching that we're being called into in these times? We'll talk about attunement, the move from scarcity to abundance, being at our developmental edges as coaches, and the healing agent that is awareness itself. Over the last 15 years, Nicholas has gained an international reputation for his transformational coaching and leadership development seminars. He works with CEOs and senior leadership teams worldwide and teaches at two of the world's leading business schools, pioneering a new vision and practice of leadership. He's also the author of Leader as Healer, an acclaimed book, won Business Book of the Year in 22. So with that all said, let's dive right in. Before we get into today's podcast, I've got an invitation for you. We're about to kick off the sixth edition of our most popular program, The Neuroscience of Change. This training is based on what revolutionary research in neuroscience has revealed about transformational coaching, essentially showing us what works, what doesn't, and why. In the program, you'll learn what happens in the brain and body when different coaching techniques are used, how to guide your clients into positive learning states that allow genuine change to occur, and why some tried and true coaching methods actually inhibit change and what we can do instead. We created this course because I learned things from the lead teacher, Amanda Blake, that truly revolutionized the way I coach. And every year, she and all the teachers bring in new, cutting-edge science that continues to illuminate the process of transformation. Amanda will be joined by the rest of our world-class faculty of coaches and neuroscientists for this program, including Dan Siegel, Alan Fogel, Claire Dale, David Trelevin, and Richard Boyatzis. It's going to be an amazing, transformative journey, so I hope you'll come and join us. You can head to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. The first class is February 25th, 2025 with Amanda Blake. And if you sign up by February the 7th, you can get the early bird discount. So just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. So Nicholas, here we are again, and it's a joy to be with you. We're going to talk about transformational coaching and I'd say stuff beyond that too. But how are you, first of all?
Well, likewise, Joel. It's very good to be with you. I'm in a fascinating and kind of constant movement, really. And I just came back from running two Leader as Healer retreats in South Africa, which were very, very intense and brought up a lot of new learning for me as well. And so I'm good. Happy to be in Puglia, back in Puglia. And great to be with you.
Yeah. I'm sure we'll talk about those retreats and what's unfolding for you. And we'll just lay a little bit of a foundation here for people who've not heard previous podcasts with you or don't know your work. And then we've got some themes and topics we want to get into, such as our capacity for seeing our clients. We're going to talk about eternity, small topic, and, you know, scarcity and abundance and how that relates to coaching. But first of all, could you just tell us, in a sense, like what do you feel is the call for coaches in our times, you know, these times we find ourselves in? And just speak a little bit about the you know, what did you see as the context for the kinds of transformational work coaches can do?
Well, I think the call, which I've been saying for a while, but it gets clearer, is that the call is to be agents of awakening, with all that that means. So I do believe it's more and more important for coaches to do enough work and forever work on themselves so that we are increasingly free of the dominating paradigm that certainly in the corporate world is so imbalanced and so out of harmony, and to really stand for an awakening and healing process with our clients, which helps them really move basically from one paradigm to another paradigm, no less than that. So I don't, I think it's absolutely time to stop playing the game of collaborating and to be very, very clear. And in a way, I think there's a call for us as coaches to be teachers as much as coaches, interestingly, and to really teach what it means to be more awake and what it means to be on a path of healing and to be open about that. And that, of course, demands of us that we will forever do our own inner awakening and healing work. And I think that's the state of the world. You know, we're in, obviously, in various degrees of crisis. And at the same time, I really feel it's an extraordinary time to be alive, really extraordinary time, because although it's very difficult to measure such things, there is a sense of a real wave of awakening taking place globally. I'm also following very closely what's happening in the US, and it's fascinating, totally unexpected in a way. I mean, we're July 30th, so about 97 days till the election. So that's just to me a symptom as well movements of awakening. I don't see them as necessarily going to save us from crisis, but they're definitely creating some kind of new culture. I do believe and feel that. And I think as coaches, we have to stand for that absolutely 100% against the current paradigm in a way. It's like, wake up. It's time to wake up with all that that means.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what does that mean? And could you say more about the paradigm that we want to rally against? And just one thing I have around that is, do you think there's a danger potential if we rally against something that it actually becomes more difficult to make the shift, or we, in a sense, we're creating more separation or making people wrong for being in a certain place? And I say that whilst acknowledging, like, you know, there's an obvious need for some kind of shift. But there's also a lot of polarization and factions, you know, factions against each other. So, yeah.
I don't see it or experience it in that way. First of all, I don't make people wrong, but I point out that from an early age, we're getting railroaded in a way into a way of being dominated by thinking, thinking, thinking that does not lead anywhere very, very useful. Although it's like thinking has become sovereign. And I think that has to be broken. And I point that out very clearly. And people really get it, not with any sense of being judged. My experience actually is that in the corporate world, which is mainly where I work, that more and more people are desperate. And so when something... And yet they've never had a really clear, different possibility outlined for them. So generally my experience is, because I've got very practiced at languaging this as well as my own development. So my experience generally now is that people are like, ah, okay, right. So there really is something quite, quite different possible. So there's often a big embrace at first. And then when we get into some of the actual process, there's the like, oh, okay, because it can be scary. And it involves really breaking, for instance, the whole pattern of trying to be in control. That's huge. And mostly our mind is always trying to be in control. And that creates a very small version of reality. So, you know, once we get into the actual process, then we meet the inevitable bumps. But my sense is that deep down, people are very, very welcoming of a very coherent new possibility presented with clarity and a lot of love. I make the paradigm wrong. I don't make the people wrong. And that's very different. That's very different. People really understand it. You know, even if I talk about something like doing and being and the different parts of doing and being, and people like, oh my goodness, whoa, yeah, I'm completely consumed by doing. Or I ask people to remember how it feels when they're really connected with their body, like how good that feels, how alive they feel. And everyone can remember that. And then I say, so how much of each day do you feel like that? And it's like 5%. And I'm like, so do you see what we've bought into? And it doesn't have to be like that. Do you see what we're missing? We're missing. It's like we're functioning at 20% at most of our full capacity. So, you know, I do have, I think, a skill for languaging this to people who are very stuck in left brain, very stuck in thinking. And at least initially, they really, mostly really buy into it. And then there are the one of the most, you know, and then we do somatic work, and I have a way of taking people to really connect with their body. And again, mostly after that, people are like, wow, I haven't felt like this for a long time, and my mind is much quieter. Wow. So that step goes usually very well. And then there's always a bump when we hit the emotional, because that's where we're most trying to stop feeling, for good reason. Again, it's not wrong. It's for very good reason. But, you know, we navigate that, and then more or less quickly we get through to everything needs to be felt. And that's radically different from the current paradigm, radically different. Everything needs to be felt as and when we feel safe enough and held enough. And there's no positive, there's no negative. And then we understand the architecture of contraction and how that began earlier in our childhood. And what I love as well, and I'm sure it's true for you, is that my whole understanding of that just gets more and more clear in a way. Also in myself, absolutely also in myself. I've been through quite substantial inner healing work recently and awakening work. So once we also, people understand the whole architecture of what happens in our life, and how our natural life energy gets, meets a kind of no from the world, and the effect of that physically, and then in the whole way we perceive the world, and the whole way we have to fit in with the world. People understand that once it's clearly explained. And I think it's profoundly simple. It's beautiful, actually. I hesitate to say it. I don't think we need complex psychologizing. Actually, I think the basic realities are profoundly simple. And if we work with them in certain ways, big change happens. But the biggest thing for most people, in certainly in corporate life, but not only, is to realize that, as Einstein said, our mind must become our servant, because it's a very, very bad master, very bad master. And if we're primarily located, as most people in corporate world are, in thinking, like, who am I? I'm a thinker, and the rest of me is pretty much on the fringes, then I'm by definition living in a small version of reality, and a very limited and rather dry version of reality, and often with a huge amount of numbness inside, and not much joy, not much wonder, not much freshness, not much freshness, because freshness will never occur through thinking. Anyway, I said a lot, but I hope I answered your question.
Before we dive into some of the themes, so Could you say something about the process of awakening for you? I'm hearing in a way you speak about that now, that you know there's this healing and awakening process, and that it's about feeling what's been unfelt. So there's an embodied sense, and that the coach can help somebody, whether that's an individual or group, to begin to move into that process of feeling where healing and awakening can take place. So
yes,
could you just speak about that for a moment? Yeah.
Which parts?
Yeah, good question.
Because there's
it's a big question.
Yeah, they're in a precise
way, which is in a way, like, could you speak about the path? The path and the role of healing,
okay.
And how a coach can invite somebody into that sense of feeling in a way that allows for healing and awakening to take place. Yeah.
Well, first of all, this might seem like a sidetrack, but it's actually central. And what was beautiful for me in South Africa is that there were certain themes I've been working with for a long time, but they just came into a new level of kind of crystal clarity. And one of the biggest ones is, you know, I've been working literally 45 years with the body. And I've done wild, crazily intense, quite extreme body trainings. Which really have changed my whole experience of embodiment. And that's always kept evolving, the sense of embodiment. But in the work in South Africa, it reached a new level. And in one of the groups in particular, which was a smaller one, and people had really chosen to be there, people got embodied in a way beyond anything I've ever seen. And what that meant was, even if I was working with someone else, as often happened, like I would work with one person in front of the group, everyone was feeling it all in their body. And therefore going through revelations sometimes in their own process because of feeling everything in their body. So I think this is one of the biggest shifts for all of us. I said that for a long time, but it became clearer than ever. Because, and in the work, I call that, I explain that as a relocation insight. Because if we're located subconsciously as thinker, and the majority of people, their primary inner location is thinking, right? Now, how does that change? Initially, the biggest lever we have, as far as I can see, is the practice of paying attention. Because if I understand what it means to pay attention, and most people get it fairly quickly, let's say I start to really pay attention to my body. And by the way, as we know, our brainwave frequency changes, and paying attention to the body activates the right brain. We know that in neurologically. So the moment I really pay attention, reality starts to change, interestingly. So that's like the first portal. Even when we meditate, because that's a part of the work as well, teaching people about meditation. And the beginning of meditation is kind of mindful paying attention, not trying to change anything, but paying attention. And then we do some body work. Maybe we do Qigong as well. Maybe we just dance a bit sometimes. And obviously, one-to-one on Zoom, that's not so possible, although it's possible. And gradually the body, because the body went offline, I think we really need to understand that. Because as a child, you know, we start in full exuberance, right? Mostly. And as children, initially, our bodies are like totally open. We feel everything. We feel fully alive. But then as the world starts to say, no, what happens inside us seems to me very clear, because it's too much to have this exuberance not welcome. And so we contract more and more in our body, and critically, we lift out of our base, our pelvis. This is very interesting. We literally lift out because it's too open to be fully in our pelvis. And if the world is not responding favorably, we have to leave a bit to feel safe. And as we know, we have to fit in with whatever family ecosystem we're in. So in a way, it's like we make a whole contract that takes us away from our essence, takes us away from our exuberant, joyful essence. And we already begin to live in a reality that's more based on fitting in than on who I really am. And that happens on a very physical level. That's why, even in a simple way, if someone goes to a great yoga class or exercise class, and they come out afterwards, and at least for a few minutes, reality is different. It's not just that they're thinking, reality is different. Like their whole experience being alive is different. And that's like a pointer. You see, I believe that's how we're supposed to be all the time. Absolutely. That's our birthright. That's our natural essence. And we've come far away from that, because in that as well is freshness. Life is, wow. Life is fresh. It's, and even often full of wonder. And we've come so far away from that. And then you look at how we crave that and all the crazy things we do to try and have a moment of pure body experience, because that got so shut down. So I think a major work, both with clients, but also with ourselves, is the whole process of re-embodiment. And that's also where we meet. That's in the healing part as well, because every so often we meet very physical levels of contraction, which contain whole frequencies of hurt, of anxiety. And we need to meet those full on from a very clear, loving frequency, because then they dissolve. They dissolve. And I used to not, one thing I, you know, I feel on a very beautiful kind of learning edge now, more than ever before. And we talked about that. So maybe we should come back to that, because I think it's very essential for all of us. It's only occurred to me recently, or also through some teaching I've come into contact with, that actually everything can be healed. I never used to believe that, but I now see that if we work in the right way, I don't know about everything or how long it will take, but huge amounts of healing can really take place. So the core anxieties we carry start to actually really dissolve, not just have a temporary kind of relief because we're somehow being held in that. But the other thing, of course, is that whenever we really, really get present with some kind of emotional process, what always happens afterwards is that my body feels more open. Oh, that's really interesting. I've seen that for years. Like someone actually feels their anxiety, really locates it in their body, and is held with a lot of love just to be absolutely feel it. There's nothing to change anyway. You can't change things. Just feel it. Don't need to understand it, because people immediately go into wanting to talk about it. No. Just feel it. Always this sense, my body starts to open. Isn't that fascinating? So I went on a bit of a sidetrack there. But then, of course, the awakening comes more naturally online. What is awakening? Maybe we should give a definition of awakening. It's a bold thing to do.
tricky words to get
well,
into.
Well, not really, not really. Yes and no, because, you know, we have thousands of years of wisdom traditions, and they all say something very similar, and that's very important. And they all speak
they
about
I
what?
I think they do and they don't. So yeah, let me, I want to, yeah, you go first. Yeah.
Really? Okay, well, that was an interesting conversation. Maybe I'm naive, but my sense is that they all speak in one way of being able to regularly reside in a dimension of reality that is timeless and eternal. Like, I love there's a beautiful metaphor I use in my work with clients in the Jewish mystical tradition, where they talk about if you open any page of a book, you have all the black letters, but you also have a white page. And we get only into the black letters. So meditation practice, if it's proper practice, naturally for me opens what we could call the white page. But the white page has many levels, as far as I can see. Like, my sense of eternity seems to get bigger and bigger, bigger and bigger. And then it becomes a question of, I think for me, it's always seemed so, but again, it suddenly got much clearer. What does it mean? Like, I love Rumi's phrase, live in the nowhere that you come from, even though you have an address here. So for me, it's a daily kind of practice about being in both at the same time. So whatever is happening in this world, can I remember just to pay attention that the white page is always open? It can't not be. Like, the Hebrew version of God is always was, always is, always will be. Nothing here affects that other dimension, in my understanding. And it's always there. The Sufis say, God is never far from us. It's we who go far from God. Same thing, you see, for me anyway. But I also try and teach this, because what does it mean? Like, even now, for us or for our listeners, what does it mean that even as we're talking, there's a part of our attention that can reside in a totally other dimension? That's, for me, an essential part of awakening, that becomes more and more available and constant. Does that make sense?
What's that experience like for you, that you can, are you in greater contact with that other dimensionness?
I do feel so, yeah. I feel it just sometimes. All it requires for me is to just stop for a moment and notice it. And when I notice it, it gets bigger. It seems to take less and less effort to, unless I'm totally triggered by something, which obviously still happens.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's coming to you as we speak in this way?
Well, one thing that comes to me is a certain kind of stillness.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, right.
And space.
Yeah. Because I think it's also just to say, sorry, just interrupting, I know, but it's also important to see that this is far, far, far beyond the mind.
Yeah. And somehow it feels there is a capacity of the mind, like a higher mind in some way, to be able
right.
to be able to articulate or to access that information in order for it to be expressed through language,
yes, right,
song, transmission.
Yes, exactly. Beautiful, beautiful. Because I think when we are residing in a deeper embodiment and a deeper sense of that otherness. Our mind, what's so interesting is that our critical faculties operate at a much higher level. And that's why I've been saying recently, there is no business case for not doing this. Because many organizations I come into contact with are in real crisis. And a lot of that is because they're using the only tool they know, which is this hyper analytical critical thinking. And it's not really working. It's not working. The world's too uncertain and too volatile. And that type of thinking always wants to make everything known and controllable. So people are very, very stressed. And I don't know, some big organizations I come into contact with are really in serious crisis because they don't know a different way of navigating. It's fascinating.
And I think, you know, there's this experience of the problem, the energy of problem solving.
Exactly.
And it's, you know, I think it's something we're all familiar with. You know, I know. I experienced it recently, and it's kind of this, it is a contraction and a fixation in a certain way on an experience that's like almost like an arm hold. You know, I remember when I was training teacher showed us the way that the American police force are trained to put people into arm locks. and actually, what it really works about it is that it's painful and your mind kind of locks in there and you feel like you're trapped. Mm-hmm. But actually what he showed is like, you can actually just get out of the arm lock through a process of letting go, you know?
That's so interesting.
So he was showing it as a metaphor for the energetic practice of relaxation around problem-solving fixation. And
absolutely. And a lot of that comes from exactly our real anxiety when we meet uncertainty. And our inability to just completely embrace being with not knowing. You see, also because I worked 20 years in the theater and all of my work was helping actors. It was 20 years of research in a way about helping actors go into a more and more open, fully embodied states and to learn how to make that more constant, not just random. And in that, any real artist knows that the deepest creativity happens through the deepest level of unknowing. You know, whether it's Beethoven walking in the wood and starting to hear music, whether it's a writer who will say, oh, a new character just walked through the door. I have no idea who this is. So I've always been very, very, very comfortable with that edge of complete unknowing. And I think, you know, I keep saying to teams, learn to sit with uncertainty. Stop trying to fix too quickly, which is the pattern. You know, as soon as we don't really know the way forward, okay, like you said, problem solving. But that shuts down so much possibility, so much possibility. And it also invites us as coaches, let's say now if we talk about one-to-one coaching, it invites us to be able to work and sit really comfortably with the places people don't want to go. For instance, someone who feels really lost, someone who feels really powerless. These are very common themes now. Someone who feels even some note of despair. If we try and fix that as a coach, we're completely obstructing a deeper opening. This is a radical part of the work. Because let's say you contact this feeling of powerless, that's a huge topic now. Because in one way, we are quite powerless. But people really use that word. It's fascinating. Once they get into how are you really, That's already a big step. But if we then say, because powerless has such a bad reputation, because it means I won't do anything, I lose my power, I lose my will. So we try and not either not feel it or fix it. But actually, if we fully embrace it lovingly and unconditionally, incredible opening happens. And then, as you said, whole new levels of ideas come in. This is one of the most radical calls for coaches. Stop trying to fix anything. And you will only do that to the degree, because if you try and fix that, it's because you're not comfortable with it. It's very simple. You can't be with powerlessness. You can't be with someone feeling totally lost. You can't just be with them with an open heart. You're not comfortable. So you try and help them not feel that. For me, that has to stop.
Or a common one I see is being of value as a coach, like getting somewhere where I know again or where I'm useful. So
right.
It's like,
if exactly.
The client starts to feel a sense of powerlessness. And actually, it can be quite difficult to slow down enough to just stay with that, because often a coach might often feel like, well, is there anything really happening here? You know, is anything really changing?
Yeah, this is an essence.
Get somewhere where they feel okay again. How did
exactly
that process would, you know, if we take powerlessness and say someone's feeling that felt sense, could you just, you would just invite them, let's just be with that, let's just include that.
But this is the very essence of what I teach as coaching. And it's very challenging for all the reasons you just said. I want to get somewhere where I feel more comfortable. Yeah, it's about the languaging is something about, is it okay that we just fully embrace that for a moment? Where, how do you feel it inside? You see, I'm noticing as I speak this, that what it also calls us to is a radical trust in life. Far beyond, because I don't know where it's going to go. That's, you know, I'm doing a lot of coaching training. And in many ways, the biggest threshold is to stop trying to be in control of the process. All you can control is helping a client. No, that's too simple. One of the main things you can control is helping a client be with what really is. But you have to give up knowing what's going to happen. Even sometimes if literally nothing seems to be happening, when all my kind of fears will come in, oh my God, they're paying me, apparently nothing's happening, blah, 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 blah. All of it, we have to go way beyond that. You know, in South Africa, there was a beautiful moment in the group, in this very mature group, this incredible black woman, said, okay, Nicholas, so if I'm working with a group and like the whole energy is dead, like nothing's happening, what's your approach to that? And I said, my approach is to invite everyone just to really feel that deadness. Just really feel it. It was extraordinary. She had like a revelation. She had a revelation about coaching, because we have to trust that. We have to trust that. Well, all the time, you know, I give an example in my book. It's a simple but very, I think, quite good example. If an actor used to come to me and say, I don't know what to do with this speech, and I'm like, that's totally the wrong question. It'll be really boring what you want to do with that speech. What's much more interesting is what will it do with you? And your job is to get into that absolute readiness so that when you start speaking that speech, something you have no idea beforehand is going to start to happen in you. That's creation happening. And I think all great artists know that, all great writers, all great musicians know that. And I think also that's why we go to live performance. We crave that. Because in high-level live performance, whatever medium, classical, rock, jazz, creation is happening through the artist. And we get such a transmission from that.
Yeah, beautiful. Have you ever had it before that you've done a session with a client and then you just stay in that feeling of like, because, you know, I've done also lots of years of coaching, and so I know very well this experience of embracing, you know, there's a something unfelt, and then they come into connection with it, and then it's just, you know, it's met in a way that it integrates and unfolds. And sometimes I've been in spaces where it just doesn't seem to do that, you know, and then you're getting near the end of the session and nothing's really changed, and then that's it, you know. And I think the invitation in those moments is, if you radically trust, then that trust has to include that sometimes things don't unfold within the timelines that we our mind wants them to.
Yeah, I guess it occasionally happens. And then I just say, okay, really, okay, okay. I don't remember that happening very much recently. Before I work with a client, I explain the whole direction of the work, both the awakening and the healing. And even if they say, yes, I want to do it, I generally say, just really go away and think about this, because this is going to be a real journey.
Mostly what I've seen with clients when that happens is there's still a subtle sense inside of them that they want to change something. You know, maybe there's a kind of voice in there of like, something should be happening. I don't know what this is.
And it's that's
actually not being included in the feeling.
Yeah, I think you're right. I'm sure you're right. And there's something else actually that comes to me, because I am working with a client at the moment, quite a senior person, who's basically going through quite a long, dark night. And it's intense. I call it with him, you're in the wasteland now. And mythologically, that's, you know, that's a very well explored territory. We don't have any time for it in our modern culture. We hate it. We medicate it. Because in the real wasteland where he is, he feels really lost and really tired a lot of the time. Like nothing is really working for him. Now, because I know him quite well, I have a very strong sense that he's literally left one whole way of being, but hasn't yet arrived fully at the new one. And often when we do meet, we meet maybe once every 10 days or so, sometimes once a week, not a lot happens. I give him this context, and then I do, but I also have a sense that even processing with him is not really that valuable. It's more like just I hold him in that space, because I completely trust. I can already feel in a way the new him that will emerge, which is so much bigger than the old him, so much bigger. So it's a very particular thing that, so I see, and he really, really trusts me. So I just see it as holding him. I said, look, I'm holding your hand through this. I'm holding you. And I've been there myself. I've been in that wasteland more than once. So I have a sense of the map, but I don't have any sense of being able to speed it up for him. In fact, I keep saying, you can't control this.
I think that's just surrender.
You have to just live it. And it's really unpleasant and really challenging. It's a very kind of soulful journey. And he understands that I'm not there to help him feel better.
And that would be a disservice, wouldn't it? Because I know those periods myself.
Yeah, I know.
There is a sacredness to them. And, you know, it's not always easy to see that inside of them. And I remember one I was in where it was so challenging, but in the challengingness, it broke my heart open continuously. And I actually started to, in some ways, enjoy, because that state, you know, I was not allowed into living in any sense of habituation.
Wow.
And so I remember when it started to subside, mainly it was relief because something beautiful was opening up. But at the same time, there was a sense of loss of this friend, you know, this container, the cocoon of dissolution. You know, and there, because we live in such habituated lives, something that can feel, I mean, it was very painful. And I feel for anyone in those places, because it can get very brutal, but it's not business as usual. And there's something that can feel liberating. You know?
If you really, it's beautiful how you describe it. It sounds like you really surrendered to it.
I mean, I think I had to, you know.
Yeah.
It was that strong that I wouldn't even say with any sense of like, I surrendered. It was just,
you had to be with it.
It's just kind of like,
did you have guidance during that? Did you have someone guiding you? I mean, with you in a
way? I did. Yeah. Interestingly, some beautiful people showed up. You know, I mean, even we had some connections in that time.
Yes, I remember.
I realized
that.
What a profound. Found
kind
of mandala of practitioners as with the, I want to ask you about some of the themes, like, because you said like seeing,
okay,
I want to talk about seeing, and maybe we've been talking about that already, but just
to say, I went through a long period of that about 4 or 5 years ago when I left a spiritual teacher I'd been with intensively for 5 or 6 years. And it was after I left, I was like completely lost for months, just in a kind of wasteland of meaning and no connection of any kind. So I, in my way, I also really experienced that. So sorry, let's go on. Yes, theme. Yeah. Okay. So one thing then I wanted to, we talked about this before we began, that there is a totally different way of knowing, different from thinking. Meaning that that reality, according to our internal level of presence and embodiment, critically, reality becomes very, very transparent. That's how I would describe it. Meaning you're with a client, and without any effort on your part, their whole interior architecture is open. And it's not a cognitive process. And I find that just getting deeper and deeper. And it's remarkable in a way. It's really remarkable because it's a completely different type of knowing that I think our culture has forgotten about. It's certainly not taught to us in school. And it's really remarkable because I'm not much in favor of psychologizing, which sometimes I think is a limit. And sometimes I think, well, that's just my path, because I'm understanding more and more a bit. I'm learning a lot about the whole inner architecture that we walk with. And like earlier this year, I began to notice in the people, I have a group who's training very intensively with me in coaches, in coaching. And I began, and they would keep sending me videos of their sessions. And I began to see that the very thing I prized so much, which was this kind of very precise and unconditional emotional processing, I just began, something in me began to say, it's not enough. It's really not enough. Before, I thought it was almost the most important thing, especially when you dealt with kind of intergenerational patterns. And I began to just, okay, so what more is there? And then something evolved with this group. We had an intensive retreat together. And I began to notice I was speaking about, I called it core topics in a person, which is kind of something about the whole way we are in the world, our whole fundamental filters. And now I think it's moved another level. And this is also through some very, very strong mentoring I've had, where I begin to see some of this in myself, which are kind of, it's very hard to say what they are, but it's like core programs. But they're not psychological. It sounds like they're psychological, but they're frequencies in us. But they are literally the whole way we relate to the world. And I've begun to notice in working with clients that I can suddenly see these in a new way, see them, feel them. It's fascinating, really fascinating. And when I name them, it's like, it's like, I call it the acupuncture needle, you know, when you name something with absolute precision and with a transmission of love and care, it's literally like the acupuncture goes into the whole ecosystem of the person. And they suddenly can see that. So I give you a personal example for me, which you witnessed actually, because we were in a group. And it's a pattern I've known about for a long, long time in myself. And I've worked with it a lot, so it had definitely got much smaller. But because of a particular project that's maybe happening, I began to notice again in me this need to be someone, like to be someone special. That's obvious in my childhood where that comes from. I was brought up with a celebrity father and a mother who lived vicariously off his celebrity, and like really got off on it, as it were. So I grew up with this whole inner program that unless you were somebody famous, basically, or doing something that had a lot of, you know, effect on the world, you were of no value. But this was mirrored to me in such a vivid way because I brought it very nakedly because I could feel it in me and was kind of beautifully guided to feel it. And suddenly the whole architecture of that became much clearer to me. And since then, there's definitely been a healing of that. I wouldn't say it's 100% healed, but significantly. And that I see as relating to it all. It's all interconnected because it's given me a quite new experience and understanding of this core movement from scarcity to abundance inside. And the nature of that is that in scarcity, we're always looking for some kind of mirroring. So our fundamental sense of ourselves gets very interlocked with what's coming back to me from the outside. And it's actually so we're always, to put it more simply, we're always trying to fill something in one way or another, through experiences, through whatever, through things, whatever. And it's an impossibility. Like you can never fill that. So it seems, I mean, this is just a deepening of what I already knew, that only by meeting that head on does something happen whereby that fundamental need, which goes right back to childhood when I had to fit in, really starts to melt. That's how I've experienced it in myself. And then I'm more and more just rooted in my pleasure in life, my inspiration in life. And it's much, much less important what comes back to me, much, much less important. And I think what I now see is that in the fundamental, I think it used to be called ego, or now I would call it the separate self, is predicated on that. It sits on that foundation of separateness, at the core of which is this referencing the outside and always trying to fill something. I have a much more acute sense of that now, in quite a new way. It's very interesting. It's part of my developmental edge that I'm on in myself and in my work. I see it so clearly in people. I see the whole construction of the separate self in a quite new way. I think we would have previously called it the ego. I haven't ever used that word, but and when that's dominant, we're actually in an endless quest to feel safe, to feel secure, and somehow to feel satisfied. But it's an impossible quest. There's nothing that will make us feel secure from the outside or really satisfy us other than temporarily, very temporarily, until suddenly we wake up and, you know, even when everything's going beautifully and we wake up in the morning and it's like, how come I don't feel very good?
Can you, yeah, it's beautiful. And being in that experience with you and your reflections, I was very touched by that experience. Your reflections helped me start to see in my own experience that same process.
Right.
The question I have is, what made that experience different from emotional processing? Because you could almost say, like, yeah, in emotional processing work, I felt this part of me that wanted to be special, and I felt the felt sense of the emotion, and I just allowed that to be there. Into what made this different from that?
That's such a great question, I think, because it really gets to the core of something. I think there are two things that made it different. One was how nakedly I brought it. So I could know about it, but there was a kind of nakedness in it. And also at one point, a feeling of the child needing to be someone to get love and everything. That's one thing. It was more naked than I've ever sat in it, let's say. And then the other thing is the frequency with which it was met. And here we get into the metaphysics of light and darkness. And the fact that if we call that darkness, because it's a contraction, and it's fully authentically felt, more than I'd ever done, actually, and it's met with this frequency of light, darkness melts into light, and that's a metaphysical reality. And I begin to live that more in myself and in my work. Whereas that's what I mean, that I think now, I do believe now everything can be healed, but only in that way.
How does that show up when you're with people, that you sense them in that way that we're describing now? Like, is it something you see? Is it like a sense?
That's always very difficult to talk about, because it's very difficult to describe it. It's such a direct knowing. I don't know. I know we've talked about this before. I mean, I do. What I remember, for instance, is that when I worked with actors, okay, I think I can answer that a bit. When I worked with actors, I could always see exactly where their energy was blocked or not. It was obvious to me. Now, was that a seeing? Was it a feeling? I think it was both. But I do think that it comes back to how embodied we are, because I think this type of direct knowing is, I think, is pretty much 100% a function of how open our body is. I really do. It's fascinating. I mean, it's such a rich inquiry. I don't think there's, maybe someone else would say different, but that's my experience. That as my body, you know, even after 45 years, is in whole new dimensions of feelingness. So the knowing gets just clearer and clearer. It's a knowing, it's a direct perception. It's very hard to describe it because it's so outside the paradigm we got used to living in. So if you say, how do you know? It's very difficult to say because it's such a direct sensing, seeing, feeling, and it's totally effortless. And it has nothing to do with thinking.
I mean, I can relate to this. I'm not saying it's the same thing, but you know, particularly I think of when I come off some of these retreats and then I go and meet someone and then I'm like, whoa. Okay. I'm like,
exactly.
Like I did, I met someone in our team and I was like, what's going on? And then they
you
said,
no, that's not it. Right.
And I just gave a few words to what I was seeing. And then there was an outpouring of emotion and sharing that went in a very beautiful direction.
Exactly.
It's like it becomes kind of obvious, or
it becomes obvious, and it's totally a function of our vibration. Totally a function of that. And that vibration is to a large degree a function of how open our body is.
So coaches listening to this, like, I wonder how trainable this is as a skill. And I know it is because we can learn this, but the danger is we start to kind of, our mind takes it and makes it a how-to with steps, when this is something very different. And maybe it's about, like what you're saying, there's the integration. The more we do our own, and we enter our own embodiment and subtle energy opens up in our system, the more that capacity just comes online. But I'm just wondering what you might say for people who are listening to this and feeling inspired, because I think many coaches are now. Everything you share about what you see inside of the corporate world, like I see there's more and more interest in the coaching community and people in working in this way, especially as AI comes in. And you know, it might be that AI will have access to every single therapeutic and coaching modality ever invented on the moment, in the spot that it can offer a client, you know, and so anything process-based.
But it will never in 100 years be able to do what we're talking about.
No, so that's my point. Yeah, it's like this is a very different frequency of work.
Well, it's a very big question. And again, it's one I'm constantly exploring. And I am, if I may say for a moment, offering an online training starting in November, which is far more extensive than any training I've ever offered. Far more hours with me, also with my team, also one-to-one sessions. So you're absolutely right. I mean, we know this. It's not like here's the manual and then you'll be able to do this. So there's an immersive process, there's a guidance process, there's a practice process, and there's my own inner work. So it's all that goes towards, and I do see the people I'm training more intensively, I do see them moving into more this. But it doesn't happen like I can teach you this, 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 and this. It's a mixture of all the attentional practices. Like, you know, I teach something called the backward circle so that I'm constantly in touch with myself and you at the same time. I don't get lost in you, and I also don't get lost in me. That's a very specific practice. Then the more, because anyone who does train with me goes through a lot of their own healing as well. So that naturally then opens this seeing that we're talking about. And there's the meditation, there's the awakening practices as well. So it's a kind of multi-level composition of input, really. But it's definitely not a normal kind of curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, more and more when I work with groups, like the second day of the first leaderless healer retreat, I just came in the morning. We did an early morning Qigong and meditation, but then after breakfast, when I came in, I just said, so does anyone want to share anything? 2.5 hours later, five people had just been through really intense process because it's cooking. It's cooking. And I think the same thing happens in an immersive online training. So I do believe that people who are coming on that training, and it's filling quite nicely, will go through a very transformational process, not just in their work. Well, they'll first go through a transformational process in themselves, and therefore their work will go through a transformational process. And also, I'm not, you know, it's not like teaching the Yanni method. It's opening everyone to work in a very essence way, and in the most deeply true and attuned way, and that will look different in each person.
Yeah.
So when I look at someone sends me a video, I'm looking at their inner state as coach. And I'm looking at, are they still trying to make something happen? How are they still stuck in using clever language, you know, or patterns of language that become habitual, to use a word you used before? And how much are they really attuned to the person they're working with?
This is a great way, a place to bring in being at our developmental edge, because what you share there for me sparks my own journey with, and I've shared this a bit more on the podcast recently, with how, yeah, there's a way my coaching opens up into a new territory, and it's thrilling. And then suddenly the experiences we start to have are, you know, feel very profound, and
yes.
And then at some point it just starts to get a little bit stale, or there's a kind of familiarity to it. And what I've learned now is that that's an invitation for me back to my developmental edge, you know, that maybe there's a way in which what was once spontaneous and fresh has now become slightly habituated, and there's an invitation beyond what I know in that moment, back to that edge where, and you know, and so my question is, like, I'd love you to speak about what you feel is the importance of this. And just one thing I want to weave in for you is, like, I've noticed, like, I started to ask myself, what kind of experience do I want to have in my coaching? As a coach, yeah. Which,
beautiful.
You know, because we always think, you know, what, in a way, like, we're always so focused on our clients, you know, what, I'm not trying to create a particular kind of experience for my client, but, you know, I have a kind of philosophy and a kind of container I want to create. But when I started to include myself in that, then...
What did you come up with? It's a lovely question. It's making me think as well.
Well, first of all, what came up was I want to be in my deep aliveness, and that comes at being at my edge, and it comes from what I noticed as well is it's daring to let go of my own excellence.
Oh, beautiful.
So there's a way that, like, when I evolve, like, my genius comes in, but then it can become just a little, after time, it can become a kind of thing I do, you know, it gets a little bit encrusted.
So, okay.
And I become really good at it as well, but it's like moving back into that place of radical trust radical surrender.
What's the you're I think you're formulating an important question. Can you what do you have a sense of what
Yeah, for you.
What is the question then?
Well, so I think for you the question is, what's at your developmental edge, and what do you think of the importance of coaches thinking about their developmental edge?
I think it's of ultimate importance in our life. Because otherwise, again, to use a word you used, things can become a bit stale. And I think that usually happens, I think, because our mind comes in and thinks, oh, I've got this now. I understand this now.
Right.
And so I think it's interesting because in many ways I feel more at a developmental edge than I ever have. And at the same time, in another way, I have more to teach than I ever have. So, you know, I like that the two sit so, like there's so much, right? Even here, I hear myself saying, I think that's right. So I think the certainty of our mind is a very big danger. And our practice has to be, whether it's with a group or with a client, to go in really empty and really willing to be present. No, okay, let me see, I'm learning as I speak. First of all, to do everything we can to be in the highest frequency we can before we start working. And that's, you know, personal practice, whatever it is. It may be, for me, it's always often like tuning into the white page. Really bathing in the white page. So I come into a session or I come into a group and I'm that whole dimensionality is very, very open. And then being willing to really be with what arises and being able to not wish it to be anything other than what it is. And the learning is, you know, it's like, again, it's interesting to go back to the theater. If an actor gives an amazing performance one night, and the next night says, okay, now I want to try and do something similar, it's already a disaster. Because the whole reason it was an amazing performance was that they were present and open. And actually actors will, it's very interesting because they will say that in those performances where they were really open, they could say lines they said 100 times or 500 times and they would feel it was the first time they said it. I think that's really beautiful. So this is a call to us to be in that absolute innocence as well.
Yeah.
It's beautiful to see your face.
Well, I'm someone that feels a lot when people share things. So as you talk about that innocence, it just pulls me right into the perceptual spontaneity and like wonderment, you know, of like
exactly
this moment, fresh, spontaneous.
Yeah.
And
also to, it's more difficult, you see, to even articulate this, but it's something about seeing the essence of a person, seeing the light in a person beyond all the stuff that they're in. That's also another kind of knowing.
Yeah.
And radiating that as well. You know, I'm contemplating writing another book, which is not a nice thought. But people keep telling me you have to write another book. And it's going to be very short, I think. Anyway, It'll be a leadership book. And the working title is To Be a Blessing.
Yeah.
Because I think in a way that's our highest calling in life and in work.
Yeah.
Like, what is it I bring to each situation I'm in? What vibration do I bring? You know, and obviously when we're getting triggered and anxious, we're bringing that. But how can we do everything possible to be a blessing, which means I'm really present with love and clarity and seeing the light in people, in everything, and really letting go of judgment. Big calling, because if we really aspire to that, then we see how much time we're judging.
It's a beautiful practice.
Mm.
One that I imagine, yeah, does put you right in touch with how much you're walking around labeling, judging, experience, people.
Yeah, and you know, after the workshop in South Africa, people were writing, and several people wrote, I've had the most unbelievable encounters with people on my way home.
Mm.
Everything is dependent on what we're transmitting out. I do see that more and more clearly. Everything is dependent on that.
Yeah. A beautiful invitation into seeing the light in others.
Mm.
Mm. And refining that capacity.
Yes. Yeah. Because we're also, I mean, it's a big word to bring in, and I know we're nearly time, out of time, because we're also talking about liberation. Inherent in all that we're talking about is liberation. The liberation to be my abundant, inspired, joyful essence that somehow long ago got compromised. And I think the more people who cross that threshold in the world, it can only be good.
Yeah. Amen to that.
Mm.
I think let's just savor in that for a moment.
Yeah, it's such a lovely frequency as we've been speaking. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Nicholas. And I don't know if there's any other questions I have. We did talk about exploring influences. We can also leave that one, and I could just ask you again about the program for coaches you have. Do you feel?
It's all on our website. If people go to www.thematrixdevelopment.com, it's all there. It's all there. I also have an upcoming book club, actually, 7-hour-long meetings starting very soon, where I'll talk through each chapter of the book. So not the process at all, just for people who are curious about the Leader as Healer book.
Yeah.
And then a Leader as Healer retreat here again in October, I think. It's very powerful when people gather. And the venues here in Puglia are just absolutely breathtaking. But the coaching is going to be very strong. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I hope people feel inspired to come and join you with that. Yeah, thanks, Nicholas.
Thank you so much, Joel.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training, The Neuroscience of Change. This program reveals the biology of change, showing us what happens in the brain and the body when different coaching techniques are used. You'll learn how to work with the innate pathways of change in all of us so you can create powerful transformation with your clients. Just go to coachesrising.com/neuroscienceofchange to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by February the 7th.
Here we are, we're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com put your name in the sign-up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.